to Come Read With Me. I'm Jeff, and this is my world. This podcast is about getting to know my friends better by reading a book with them and discussing it. Some of these friends read a lot, some read a little, and some, honestly, I'm not sure can read, but we'll find out, that's for sure. Today's guest reader is Peter. Peter and I have known each other for quite a few years now. I think it's been about 4 years, something like that. He works for the government, air quotes, and is simultaneously working towards his PhD. He also carts me around to various bookstores when he's heading in that direction, and we eat at this really great restaurant in Cambridge called Border Cafe. Say hi, Peter.
Hi. Glad to be here.
He doesn't usually sound like that.
I do. I do have a cold, so I'm going to apologize in advance for coughing and scratchy throat. Although I do think my voice sounds better like this, so.
He's got, and whereas I get a drag queen voice, he's got this nice, just deep voice. And we don't have to talk about your job, because I know it's sort of like, meh. Everyone gets at that point. But you've worked in state politics. Is it politics, or would you just say state government? For a long time now.
It's a mix of both. I mean, I've worked for the state of Massachusetts for 9 years in different roles in the legislature, and I've done a lot of political campaigns. So I've done both. It's good experience. I'm glad for it. But as you mentioned, I am trying to vector out and sort of jumpstart my career a little.
Yeah, you want to do new things. And PhD? You are history?
Political science. PhD in political science with a concentration in public policy and American government. It's going well-ish. I got through my comp exams. I'm trying to get my proposal done. The proposal's more or less done. At this point, it's like almost 60 pages, so it's just going to take me a long time.
Yeah.
But it's good, and you know, you and I have talked. I've kind of gone up and down with it, but I do want to finish it. I don't know that I want to be I don't want to be a tenure-track faculty member, which begs the question, why am I doing a PhD to begin with? That is a great question. Topic for another podcast. but I do want to finish it.
Yeah. Now, so you are doing it part-time, which is good because you're able to keep working.
Right.
And
right.
At the end, we'll talk about reading recreationally, but did you have to read a lot going into comps, like books, or were you like well-prepared going in?
It's funny. They give you a reading list for your primary concentration area and your secondary concentration, and then another reading list for methods, like, you know, quantitative or qualitative methods. And there are policy reading lists, I think, had maybe the most amount of books on it. Like, there were over 24, maybe 36 books on this list. But they tell you, at least at the time, don't try to read all the books. You're supposed to be pulling specific knowledge from each book. And at least in the Northeastern program, I assume in many programs, you rely on the people that have gone through it before you. And, like, we pass notes down from, like, class to class. It's like, oh, here are the comp notes. So I went through every bit of the cumulative notes that I had, and I made sheets. I wrote sheets so it was a lot of reading.
Yeah.
And then I converted the sheets into note cards, and then I just had my note cards with me for, like, a month, just constantly trying to pull out, oh, this author, he had 4 main points, and this author had this method, and this one thought, this is his take on the American presidency.
And so you're just like, I'm done.
Well, but I don't think I managed to do. In fact, I know during that span, and that was November of last year, 2014. I didn't do any recreational reading.
Yeah, I remember
at all. I didn't play any video games. I didn't do a lot
of
things.
He's also a gamer. Peter's a gamer.
I am a gamer.
Second one. So you took a big break.
I took a big break, and then when the comps were over, I know I did a little bit of recreational reading, but more in, I think, the sci-fi-ish realm.
Okay.
I haven't read any.
We'll get back to that. The last question of this sort of section is the bell jar. You randomly asked me, so you're like, hey, do you have the bell jar? And I was like, I happen to have a copy of the bell jar. Why do you want it? And you were like, well, I want to read it. And I was like, okay, but let's do a podcast. So here we are. But why the bell jar? You just randomly.
Well, this is an interesting story. I am not ashamed to admit that I was on Grindr, and someone in, I think, one of their Grindr descriptions had the opening sentence, or actually the opening phrase from the bell jar as his description. It was the middle of the summer, too, so it made sense. Something about being it was a queer and sultry summer, the summer they electrocuted Ethel Rosenberg. And I actually messaged this guy, which is so. I usually don't message people on Grindr.
You're pretty good. You almost got a verbatim. You had it right the first time. Anyway,
I think it just says the Rosenbergs, or
yeah, it's just.
And I was like, and I messaged this guy. I'm like, wait, like Ethel Rosenberg from Angels in America? knowing that she was an actual person in real life. And he's like, yeah, it's from the Bell Jar. Thus endeth the conversation there. So right. I thought about it. I'm like, you know, I should like read the Bell Jar because my only frame of reference, and we talked about this, was an episode of Daria, I think the fifth season, about how they were encouraged to try to fail. After everyone has failed and they're really depressed, one of the background characters is just reading the Bell Jar. And I'm like, that must be like a really depressing book or something. So
yeah, well, there's an entire it might be BuzzFeed, it might be on Goodreads or something like that. But there's an entire list of all the books mentioned in Daria.
Oh,
so all the ones she's reading, all the ones you see in the background, like the Bell Jar.
Oh, you've got to email me that link.
I'll have to see if I can find it. It was really interesting because my response to you was, oh, do you want the actual Bell Jar or do you want whatever Meg Wolitzer is working on? It's like a young adult novel based on the Bell Jar called Bell Czar. I was just really confused. I was like, why would you want to read a classic book? I don't even want to read this book. But that made sense. And then here we are reading it.
Yeah.
When we come back, we are going to jump right into the Bell Jar. And we're back. And we are going to discuss the Bell Jar. As asked, I'm going to read the blurb on the back of the book. And then we're going to jump right in. So this is The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath. A vulnerable young girl wins a dream assignment on a big-time New York fashion magazine and finds herself plunged into a nightmare. An autobiographical account of Sylvia Plath's own mental breakdown and suicide attempt, The Bell Jar is more than a confessional novel. It is a comic but painful statement of what happens to a woman's aspirations and a society that refuses to take them seriously. A society that expects electroshock to cure the despair of a sensitive, questioning young artist whose search for identity becomes a terrifying descent toward madness. What's bad is these commas look like periods, and these periods look like commas, and that's why there's some weird breaks there.
You know, I didn't even read the description on the back, because I have not read a book in so long that actually had a description on the back.
Yeah,
I'm used to opening the front cover, so I did not even read that before I did. Wait. I'm actually glad I didn't, because I went into this completely blind.
The only thing I knew is that she had killed herself. Did you read the afterword?
I skimmed through it to... kind of her story.
Let's just start with that, because that was one thing I thought the line was very, very blurred between biography, autobiography, memoir, fiction. Like, what the hell is this? I think technically they call it fiction, but they just, on here, called it autobiographical. Like, what would you say?
I'm going to go with fiction based on historical events, like her life.
Yeah. I mean, pseudo-fiction,
right,
which is what I call it.
Okay, I guess that's a good term. I kind of break it into three parts. I mean, the totality of the book is when she's in New York, then when she returns home to... She was from Winthrop, so I assume in this it's supposed to be Winthrop, Mass.
She's living in Wellesley.
I thought they lived in Wellesley, then they moved.
They lived somewhere, and then they moved to Wellesley.
Oh, see, I thought when she came home from the summer, from the assignment, she wasn't in Wellesley anymore, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, I mean, it might be, because that is one thing that's interesting. The only city they mention in here is New York and Boston.
Yeah.
And then Chicago, because they talk about Chicago, but they don't actually say where she lives. They just talk about, but in the back, that section talks about Wellesley. They didn't mention Winthrop.
Yeah. And then, like, the third part being when she, I think, emerges in the home that she's living in. Mm. She's moving from house to house within that home. And so in my mind, it was three parts. I liked the first and third part, the descent into depression. I mean, it's good. It's well written. And I suppose you're supposed to take from it a sense that how little people knew about mental health. I assume this is like the 60s or 70s this is set in.
I think it might be a little older. For some reason, I was thinking
When all this was happening to her, if I'm reading the biography right, it was like the 40s or 50s. But I'm not sure where this is supposed to be set.
Oh, no, it was. It was originally published in the 70s.
Yeah, so... And let's assume late 60s, early 70s, which sort of jives with the way she describes the world, or at least Boston at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, the reliance on electroshock to fix everything, yeah, I get that. But I just remember, it just like was too rubber band, the way she sort of, like the depression was just like a snap of the finger.
Yeah.
It's like, it didn't seem like things were going that badly, and then all of a sudden she falls off a cliff. And maybe that's because I don't understand, like, the depths of depression.
But also, it made you wonder if she had something else, not just depression. Like, was she bipolar? Did she have, like, something
right,
like that?
Because
have you ever read Girl Interrupted?
No.
Susanna Kaysen? Also set in Boston. Also questionable whether it's fiction or autobiography. That one's dealing, again, with bipolar and depression. There was a lot that was... when I read this, I was kind of like, huh... I feel like Girl Interrupted just borrowed this and wrote more about the time in the institution. And I feel like hers was a much more institutionalized institution, whereas right. this one was more like, it was very well off. Like her, the rich
benefactor.
Yeah, I was going to say, rich writer lady friend paid for her to be in a much nicer insane asylum than she would have been.
And it's interesting. I mean, it's a different, it really is, even if it is 40 years ago, it's a different era of healthcare to begin yeah. with, and just the sense, even the parts you see from the friend Buddy Willard, mm-hmm. that character, and like, you know, he's a resident, and just some of the references, like the Catherine Gibbs secretarial school. Like, my mother worked at a Catherine Gibbs as a night nurse when she was at Boston College. She yeah. was a nursing student, so
okay.
actually that must have been after the fact. All these dated references, which yeah. I sort of get some of them, but this idea that you could still house people in an institution and it was just accepted. And then in the 80s, we went through this phase, at least in Massachusetts, was like, no, we have to close the institutions down because mm-hmm. it's detrimental to the clients and we need to get them into the community. And now we're in this era of, was that the right way to go about it necessarily? Yeah. Or did we just need to fix the institutions, not disperse these people?
It's too much of a pendulum.
It really is. It really is. So, I mean, I like this book for a number of reasons. I think one of the big ones was like that snapshot into Massachusetts as someone who grew up here and yeah. like works for the government. So I see the intersection, like a lot of this mental health stuff that she's talking about. But I will say, you clearly, it's based on her experiences, her kind of churned through the system.
Yeah.
But also, it's funny. I mean, I noticed like a lot of it, some of her personality flares, mm-hmm. like her anger flares. I'm like, I have those anger flares. Like when she,
a lot of it, you're like, wait, do I have depression? Am I bipolar?
I know.
What's going
it's
on?
Like the part where she, like, all of a sudden, whatever grad program she applied for the writing, she's like, I will not be taking any classes here. And then she fired off the letter to Buddy Willard, be like, I have no interest in seeing you. She's like, I'm in a bad mood. I'm making all my decisions right now. I'm like, yeah. that is me on having a bad day.
I think that speaks to her as a writer. You know, she's able to write the human experience. Oh, so yeah. everybody, even if you don't face depression or whatever else she may have suffered from or experienced, I don't know what the proper mental health words are.
I think depression is still... Yeah. I mean, I would still say depression if that's what it was.
Well, but again, but I don't know if it's more, do you suffer from it or do you experience it? Like, there's something, some agency word, you know, in our political right. correct time frame. But whatever it is, I feel like everyone at some point can focus this. Like, I mean, I don't know if you've ever looked to live in New York City. Did you at some point? I know I did.
Wanted to?
Yeah, like, you considered living in New York.
I did, but I think later than most people. I didn't visit New York City until I was out of college.
Okay.
Had I done so before, I probably would have gone to college in New York just okay. because you get a sense of like that magic that people talk about. It's like, oh, I'm like living in New York, and
yeah.
even going into it knowing like you are following the path that millions have before you, and you will get chewed up and spit out the same as them, but you're still going to do it.
Because I thought she wrote that part really, really well. She basically was, she was like, you know, I came to New York to discover the world, and basically I got shat on.
Well, it's like, you know, she didn't go to New York. She went to, like, a version of New York.
She did.
Very tightly contained within these parameters, and you're going to get a treatment not everyone gets. I mean, it's the idealized version of New York, which I feel like
but
she got.
Would you say hers is better than what most people live in New York?
What she experienced, yes. Yeah. She was there as part of this glamorous, we're going to treat you like a
internship,
queen program
yeah.
and give you all these gifts and get you all this access and all this exposure. And that's the ideal version of New York. That's what everyone goes there looking for.
Yeah.
Almost no one gets it.
But even then, I feel like somehow, well, she kind of had that split because she was there for that experience. But then with Doreen, she was slumming. Like, let's face it, she was slumming.
Yeah, they're little trysty sort of,
yeah,
you know,
hanging out with questionable DJs, getting thrown in the mud on a golf course. Like, right. It wasn't all pristine and clean.
I'm not sure if you'd call it an attempted rape.
Yeah, I guess,
like,
it was.
You know, a lot of this book is probably purposely unclear, so you draw your own conclusions.
It's got that weird line of, like, she went to New York and it spit her out. Like, and then you have to be a certain type of person to go to New York and stay in New York and remain in New York.
Yeah, I mean, there are city people and there are, you know, country people and there are suburb people. And, you know, I've lived in the city for 16 years in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if that would mean I could make it New York. I mean, I bet I could. I'm
for
pretty
a while.
I'm pretty hardy as far as the urban living goes. It's its own sort of animal. And
it is.
And I don't really know if it gets into what her expectations were going into
No, because it starts in the middle.
Exactly.
It's another book that starts in the middle, and it's not really in the middle. It's in the middle of the first half. So we start, when we're reading it, she's in the middle of her New York trip, and I'm like, what, huh? And then we find out why she's there.
Right, and I mean, it's a good writing device. I kind of like a book where you really have to, like, on the first page, like, okay, what's going on here? Like, I really got to get hunkered down here.
Yes, I think you would be fine in New York. I think for me, and the reason, like, I chose Boston over New York, and I tell this to everyone, when inevitably that conversation happens, is why Boston, why not New York, is New York is a global city. It's huge. Like,
literally.
It's less overwhelming now that I've lived in Boston for some time, but Boston is very much an East Coast city. It has that identity. You know, it has that little bit of a European feel because the streets go nowhere and have no street signs, and there are a lot of Irish and British and other European people here. It's not a world city. It has world connections, obviously, but, like, New York is just going all the time to all parts of the world, and, you know, yeah, like, that's sort of what I look at it, and I've been to New York, I think, twice now since I've lived in Boston, and it's a lot smaller than it was since I've lived here for so long now, whereas, like, the first, actually, three times I went to New York, I was coming from North Carolina, or from Leeds, and, like, it was big, it was a big city, but having lived in Boston and learned to navigate all that stuff, it's kind of like, okay, it's not that big anymore.
To me, it is still big, but not like it was. I mean, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely gotten a little bit smaller, but I still like the fact that I could go there and spend a whole day in parts of the city I've never been to before.
Because
it's just so much to see. After 16 years, I'm not saying I've done it all, but I mean, I've seen quite a bit.
You've seen a lot, yeah.
I've hung out in a lot of different neighborhoods, and I was actually thinking that maybe Friday on my way home from work, I just was kind of like, is this getting played out, you know?
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, there's Boston Common again. There are the public gardens.
But that's the thing, though. Every time there's something new to discover. So we saw Black Mass, and there were parts, like, I knew the Whitey Bulger story happened here.
Yeah.
I knew Winter Hill, which is where I used to live in Somerville, right in that area. I voted in one of his hangouts. But, like, in the film, their local church is the church that's a block and a half that way.
Yeah.
And, like, that was the outside of it. And I was like, wait a minute, I walk by there all the time. Why are they filming that? So it's kind of cool, like, to discover things like that. And, like, have you been to the Harbor Islands before?
You know, I actually haven't.
See?
Like I said, I've done most of them, but there's still more to do. But I think that comment was more reflection on, like, leaving work.
Oh, yeah.
It was more of, like, you know, end of day, and it just be exciting to be like, oh, no, I've got to be at work till 8 o'clock tonight. I know that sounds like an insane thing to say.
Walk down the other side. Go over to Haymarket instead of coming down to Downtown Crossing. Change it up.
I think it's more reflection of, I've been very, as you know, I've been in a very tight routine the last few months, summer, and I'm actually kind of out of it today because I got sick. That tends to throw everything off, so.
Yeah,
there you
but
go.
No, it is, and I think part of it is just you have to go out and explore something that's not what you would do.
No, like, exactly. You got to step outside your comfort zone.
Yeah, this might be an obvious question. Did you know what a bell jar was going in?
I actually didn't. I
because I didn't either. I just wanted to know. Like, I figured it out about halfway through. I was like, oh, it's one of those things.
Yeah,
but I wasn't sure. Like,
the way she describes it, it's almost like something you'd like with cooking. It's like the cover you, like a glass cover you put on a tray, like a cake.
Yeah, like a cake thing. But, which it technically, I mean, it kind of is, but they usually have that, like, that wooden base. And, like, I guess not terrariums. I don't think that's the word, but, like, I think there's, like, a terrarium set you can do where, like, you put stuff on the inside of the circle and then you put the bell jar over it and then it, like, creates its own ecosystem, right?
Yeah, my grandmother used to have a terrarium, like, but it was, I guess if you call it an upside down bell jar. Because the cover came off the top, or at least she had it that way. So it was like a big
glass
thing, and then
on
the top. In my head, whenever I saw the word bell jar, I'd equate it with a diving bell. So
what the hell's a diving bell?
A diving bell is an old from the 19th century and probably the early 20th century. It's just using physics and water. It'd be like a big copper bell, and you'd sit on a bench on the inside of the bell, and it would lower you into the water, but there'd be, like, air pressure, and you'd pipe in, so it would keep the water from filling the bell up. So you could take the bell down in relatively shallow waters and, like, end up on the ocean floor and see what that was all about.
Weird.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to look that up, because I had no idea that's what that meant.
That was actually, I got that from the Patrick O'Brien Aubrey Maturin series.
What the hell's that?
That's,
another book series.
Naval fiction. I've read a lot of British naval fiction.
You haven't told me that. So, have you ever read a modern adaptation of a classic novel?
No.
And I'll even count, like, like those hybrid novels, like Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer and Android Karenina, like that kind of novel. You've never read anything like that?
I've seen Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. Like, I've seen the movie, but no. Okay. I'd have to think about that, unless there's, like, some comic book adaptation that I've
read. There's a bunch. Oh, my God. You need the Marvel. I'm reading the Marvel, but I also read the manga one just recently of Jane Austen. What? Mm. First manga. I was excited.
Manga. Manga. They'll get mad at you.
Manga. Manga. The only reason I ask that is so because I feel like if this were called Under the Microscope, I would have understood immediately what she was talking about. Like, you know how when some people are like,
except,
oh, I feel like I'm under a microscope?
I mean, I get the premise of what you're saying, but
she
wasn't under a microscope. It was like the way she described it. It's literally she's going on in life, and then suddenly this jar descends on her.
Yeah.
And it's just like this pressure and this depression and whatever it is, and she just cannot push it away. All of us go through like days where we're just like, I am completely at the bottom of the ocean today, and like nothing is going right. And then, you know, you lean on your friends, you lean on your family until you realize that was a bad idea.
Is there an equivalent? Because, like, I think if you told a 10-year-old a bell jar, they would look at you like you were nuts. I mean, neither of us knew what it was going into it. Like,
right. Let's see. Modern, like, a modern take on, like, the concept of a bell jar.
Yeah. I mean, I guess
something,
in a cage.
It'd be something digital. It'd be, like, something like a Facebook trending. You'd be, like, or a Twitter trend, you know, hashtag trend, something like that.
Or, like, you're in a no service zone or something.
Yeah, that's something like that.
Like
that,
no, that's what, yeah.
That actually, okay. I think that really works because it's like if you count on your connection to the outside world to drag you out of the metaphorical bell jar, then like if you're in a dead zone, let's just say dead zone. Okay, I'm totally cut off. I am stuck wherever I'm stuck and I cannot use my phone. It's like, as you know, I had no power a couple Fridays ago or Thursday nights ago. And it was just amazing because I have not lost power anywhere I've lived in a really long time.
Yeah.
And it was just, so what did I, you know, it was actually, I'm like, all right, well, so I lit some candles and I read a book. I grabbed Horatio Hornblower off the shelf. And I'm like, C.S. Forrester, he did Horatio Hornblower. Dudley Pope, he did...
So did you finish Hornblower, or had you read it before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've read all of them. Horatio Hornblower, it's kind of funny. It's one of those instances where a TV adaption gets you into the book. Because I saw the TV adaption, I think, on A&E.
Uh-huh.
And I will give A&E credit for still being a TV network that actually puts out a decent show once in a while.
Uh-huh.
Not like the crap you'll find on, quote-unquote, The Learning Channel, which I think where Honey Boo Boo might be.
No, well, that's gone. Is Horatio Hornblower part of a series?
Yes.
12 books? That's the Naval series, right?
Yeah. Midshipman, Lieutenant, Hotspur, Atropos, the three originals.
You're embarrassing yourself now, my name.
Commodore, Lord. No, it's 10.
10. But is that Napoleonic Wars?
Yes.
Okay, so those are set in the same time as Jane Austen. Those are set at the exact same time. And the reason...
It's a very popular trope. Because there are at least three other British naval fiction series set in the same era. And the only exception is the Boletho series. It starts very much earlier during the Revolutionary War.
Okay, but when was Forster writing them?
He was writing them in the earlier 20th century. Like, his claim to fame was he was escaping creditors and jumped the ship bound for somewhere.
So in the early 1900s?
Yeah, okay. It may even be later than that.
Okay.
And what often happens with these books, at least in the case of the Hornblower series, Patrick O'Brien, and the Ramage series, which I really did enjoy, is the authors die. And they just abruptly stop. Like, Hornblower had more source material in him. Patrick O'Brien, Aubrey Maturin series, which there were a lot of those. He wrote a lot of those books, but it just sort of ended.
Yeah.
You know, without any kind of conclusion for the character stories.
Okay.
And his thing was he also liked to... I learned you have to read very carefully his novels because he will throw a curveball at you, not in the last chapter or the last page or even the last paragraph, but the second to last sentence. Suddenly they'll be like, oh, and by the way, that ship they've been chasing for two books suddenly appeared over the horizon. The end.
Oh, wow.
And you're just like, ah, damn.
There's a lot of books. But yeah, no, it's really interesting because it's... Same time Jane Austen's writing her novels.
I know. I might have to pick up Jane Austen after this just to get you off my back.
But that's the thing, though, because you just mentioned it. TV series, the Horatio Hornblower, and how that has gotten you into it.
Yeah.
I'm convinced now, so I've read three of the Marvel Illustrated, so that's the Marvel has adapted classics, and the three of them that I've read were Jane Austen, and then I've just read the one manga, Jane Austen, Emma. I think that it is a great opportunity for people that don't necessarily like Jane Austen, that don't necessarily like Charles Dickens, like it's an opportunity for those of us that don't like one of them, or for those that don't like to read at all, to introduce them to the classics.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's that whole like split between just some people are visual learners, and like, so take it to the next extent, like, you've got a kid that just does not want to read Shakespeare, we'll try giving him visual Shakespeare, yeah. Or auditory Shakespeare, take him to a play. And sometimes it'll just sink in. And I'm the type of person that...
But even these are a little different. So I think with the films and the... Sorry, you can go right back to that. So
no, that's fine. Yeah.
But even with the films and the comic books, is they cut it down, they condense it to just the most important parts. And I think... I really felt after reading, especially the manga version, because it had so much more emotion than, I hate Emma. I hate, that's the one Jane Austen novel I actively do not like.
Mm.
And reading the manga version was like, okay, I want to know more. And luckily, I could answer all those questions. It's great because it might encourage them to read it. They might have to read it slower. They might have to listen to the audio version of it.
Yeah, any different way you can find to engage anyone in like a historical or like storied medium, a good way to do it. I mean, my niece, for example, is 4 years old, and she, one of the shows she watches is The Little Einsteins, and all those kids shows just sort of like blend in my head, blend together. But this one, it's all about classical music, but you'd never know that.
Yeah.
But by the end of it, like, she is humming a classical score.
Okay.
And I'm like, oh, okay, quite clever. Good for you, Sprout Network or Disney, Disney Junior or wherever the hell it was.
No. But what were you saying about learning visual versus oral versus?
Oh, nothing. I mean, I just think that, you got, however you can get people engaged into reading in general is good. The condensing, even in the manga world, for example, anime, which is like the other side of manga. I mean, most anime is based on a manga. So manga is the graphic novel, week to week story, and then those stories will be later condensed into a volume, and sometimes the volume will leave it just the essentials of the story, and then once you've got a popular manga, then you'll turn it into an anime, and then eventually it'll get to the US. And with the anime, like, an anime will usually like run for 50 episodes for a season or for the series based on the source material, and then you'll do a re-release and it'll be the same thing. It's like, okay, we'll cut all this B-plot out and we'll just do this big long movie of this one anime series. We'll just leave the, bare bones just enough for you to get the story in.
Yeah.
It's the same concept. It's just like, oh, well, we can hook people in because it's condensed, but we can also make it visually better because we have a newer level of technology for animation rendering.
We went off on a long tangent.
Yes, we did.
It makes sense. But, like, that's one of those things. Like, I think this would be... One, this is really short, so it doesn't necessarily have to be adapted.
Oh, yeah, this is a really quick read.
But it's also, it is dated. Like you said, it's a little bit dated. I think it is important part of the aspect, the electroshock therapy, both the good and the bad that she had.
Mostly bad. I guess I shouldn't say that. As a medical procedure, I mean, in Massachusetts, there's still one place that does, it's called aversive therapy. It's not, they don't like the term electroshock. I know someone who, his background is in behavioral health, and he worked with just severe mentally disabled populations, like people that just would smash their head on the floor all day because that's just what they do. And he's like, in those cases, aversive therapy can at the very least get them to stop hurting themselves. The use is big ethical. History is replete with a lot of like, oh, here's a miracle science. And I'm sure we're experiencing right now. There's something on the market that everyone's like, no, this is just the bee's knees. And then in 10 years, we're going to find out. It's like, oh, no, it was actually not that good. Yeah, maybe the paleo diet.
It's the pendulum again.
Yeah.
We're going, everything we do with the big pendulum. We can never do moderation. So sort of going back to, I mean, obviously there's a lot about the mental institution.
Yeah.
I don't know, this whole genre of kind of like, I don't know if I would call it mental health fiction, but it's kind of,
it's in response to something. I mean, we didn't even really talk about the era in terms of like the pressure. I mean, if this was 60s, 70s, then there was this pressure, and maybe she was aware of it, maybe she wasn't, that women should be doing more, and they should be trying to achieve. And I don't feel like at any point she ran into any problems because she was a woman. Like, I didn't see a lot of sexism in the way she wrote it, in terms of...
Well, that's because that's another thing. I mean, there's also the privilege, because I think she was very privileged, even though...
Well, that's it exactly. Yeah. I mean, she had a relatively easy path. Let me just put this marker now. I think the mother... is a big part of what her problems were. Like the character of her mother.
101.
Well,
oh no, it's not the character, it's her mother. If you read the afterword, her mother wrote a letter to the American publisher saying, "I know I can't stop you from publishing this, but I want you to know that every character in this book is based on a real person in this town, including myself." And all she did was change the names.
Yeah.
That's where it's like that running that fine line of is it fiction? Is it autobiographical?
Well, what would you call it? Faux?
Pseudo fiction.
Pseudo fiction. As she was going through, I mean, I can't remember the name of the doctor that ended up being like her champion. She fills the role of pseudo mother for the character. It's very clear to me that while her mother clearly loves her and has pushed her to succeed and like supports her, you know, there's a great deal of, I think, anger at her mother in real life in this book that shows up here. And this is like, yeah, you helped me, but you never forget to like mention how much you've helped me.
Yeah.
And it's like, yes, you want me to get better, but you never fail to mention how great it would be for you if I got better.
Yeah.
And some people are like that, and people get frustrated.
Yeah.
People who take care of other people get very frustrated and carry that day to day. So when they have a slip and they say something that they're really thinking, I mean, you can't be that mad about that. It's going to happen. But I think part of what was going on here was she was desperately crying out for help, but she didn't know how, or she knew enough to be like, it's not worth like telling her I'm really depressed and like thinking of, you know, putting myself in a hole in the wall and like taking pills. It's not going to do any good. So she just did it.
That was a societal shift. It wasn't just your standard generational shift. That was a societal shift. It was moving away from women only working in the home, women only being typists. Like, it was moving away from that. The sexual revolution, the female revolution, Black Power movement, all of that was, if it wasn't happening, it was on the verge of happening. It was that whole societal shift, which I think was part of the struggle. She had all of these expectations to be a mom, to be a great mom, daughter. But then she also had the societal expectations of going on to be a writer or a poet or to have her own career. And, like, I still think that's, people are still struggling with that. Like,
and
we're still
trying
to.
And that's why, like, in my mind, there's three parts to this book. And in the first part, all her anxieties and, like, her, what she wants to do, that's so, to me, that's so typical of someone in college, male or female. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, I've got this grandiose plan and this is what I want. We all had the grandiose plan in college.
I
you know?
Know what I want
to
do.
Esther, in this book, at multiple points, had help available to her.
Yeah.
Like, when she in New York, she had that copy or that editor who seemed generally interested in her succeeding. And it's just like, oh, okay, she could have asked her for help.
Yeah.
Or even some of her, like, quote-unquote, friends that were also in the program. There were people back in Massachusetts. And it wasn't until she really hit rock bottom and learned how to ask for help that she did it. So I think it's
Nolan.
Like this.
I looked up Nolan.
Nolan.
Yeah.
So I think it's this intrinsic, I don't want to say failing on her part, but it's just like inability of her to recognize that she can ask for help.
But that I think is part of the societal change, because I think we're of that next generation where we're grown up and like, if you don't know how to do it, you go figure out how to do it, and you ask whoever you need to ask to figure out how to do it. Whereas I think our parents are sort of the tail end of that generation of, you know, keep calm and carry on.
Yeah, you don't admit when you need help.
Yeah,
I think
she's
that.
Riding that line. But I think she is, because I think she's aware some of these resources are available. But the only way to do it is to a call for help by committing suicide, attempting to commit suicide.
Right. Even then, I mean, you know, we have conceptions about like what it means to get put in an insane asylum.
Yeah.
In our generation, she had the same thing. She's like, they're gonna send me to some like horribly run-down state program.
Part of that, I think, was about her mom. Because it was like, my mom's not going to want to pay for this. She'll pay for it for a little while. When I don't get better, then they're going to make me disappear.
And it's just, that is part of it. She is kind of a bit narcissistic. And, you know, it's just like, oh, woe is me. And it's just like, oh, honey, woe is everybody. You know, it's like, you think you're having a rough time. We've all had rough times. Like, talk to me. Like, summer of 2000, there was a rough time.
No, I do know what you mean. And that's why I think that it's a very apt metaphor when there's that one instance where after her first really successful shock therapy, she says, the bell jar has been lifted.
Oh, yeah.
I can hear everything. I can see everything. I thought that was a really apt metaphor. I thought it described it in a way no one has described it for me to be able to understand before. She had that fine. There's a fine line. I also thought she was a very beautiful writer. I've never read any of her poetry. Have you ever read any?
No, I haven't, but I did like this book. And I mean, I really could have finished the whole thing in one night, but I was like, okay, I'm going to stop and go to bed. But it's like, it's engaging.
Mm-hmm.
It's an engaging character. I think, and again, I had no idea what this was about going into it. The fact that it was set in Boston, or only the Boston area for most of it was like, oh, okay, because she's talking about a beach looking across at Lynn. I'm like, well, that's probably in the Hunt.
Yeah.
Or somewhere in that
Deer
area.
Deer Island and the Common.
Yeah, and this is like the prison near Deer Island and, yeah, the Common and the Green Line and, like, the elevated, that's the old Orange Line. So that was really neat. And it's like a slice of Boston, like, it's gone.
Yeah,
like, the Boston
of
the 70s and 80s is gone. And, you know, depending on who you talk to, it's a good thing or it's a bad thing. I think most people would say it's a good thing. There's no combat zone.
So that's pretty much the entire discussion. When we come back, Peter's going to do my favorite part where he reads a brief passage from the book. And we'll do any last thoughts that we have about the book. And we are back. I am now going to have Peter read a great section from Chapter 7. Esther/Sylvia, whoever it is making a long list of things she is not very good at. And for some reason, it just stood out for me as humorous. So without further ado, here is Peter.
I started adding up all the things I couldn't do. I began with cooking. My grandmother and my mother were such good cooks that I left everything to them. They were always trying to teach me one dish or another, but I would just look on and say, yes, yes, I see, while the instructions slid through my head like water, and I'd always spoil what I did so nobody would ask me to do it again. I remember Jody, my best and only girlfriend at college in my freshman year, making me scrambled eggs at her house one morning. They tasted unusual, and when I asked her if she had put anything extra, she said cheese and garlic salt. I asked who had told her to do that, and she said nobody. She just thought it up. But then she was practical and a sociology major. I didn't know shorthand either. This meant I couldn't get a good job after college. My mother kept telling me nobody wanted a plain English major. But an English major who knew shorthand was something else again. Everybody would want her. She would be in demand among all the up-and-coming young men. She would transcribe letter after thrilling letter. The trouble was, I hated the idea of serving men in any way. I wanted to dictate my own thrilling letters. Besides, those little shorthand symbols in the book my mother showed me seemed just as bad as a little T equal time and let S equal the total distance. My list grew longer. I was a terrible dancer. I couldn't carry a tune. I had no sense of balance, and when we had to walk down a narrow board with our hands out and a book on our heads in gym class, I always fell over. I couldn't ride a horse or ski, the two things I wanted to do the most, because they cost too much money. I couldn't speak German or read Hebrew or write Chinese. I didn't even know where most of the old, out-of-the-way countries the UN men in front of me represented fitted in on the map. For the first time in my life, sitting there in the soundproof heart of the UN building between Constantine, who could play tennis as well as simultaneously interpret, and the Russian girl, who knew so many idioms, I felt dreadfully inadequate. The trouble was, I had been inadequate all along. I simply hadn't thought about it. The only thing I was good at was winning scholarships and prizes, and that era was coming to an end. I felt like a racehorse in a world without racetracks or a championship college footballer suddenly confronted by Wall Street in a business suit, his days of glory shrunk to a little gold cup on his mantle with a date engraved on it like the date on a tombstone. I saw my life branching out before me like a green fig tree in the story. From the tip of every branch, like the fat purple fig, a wonderful future beckoned and winked. One fig was a husband and happy home with children, another fig was a famous poet, and another fig was a brilliant professor, and another fig was E.G., the amazing editor, and another fig was Europe and Africa and South America, and another fig was Constantine, Socrates and Attila, and a pack of other lovers with queer names and offbeat professions, and another fig was an Olympic lady crew champion, and beyond and above these figs were many more figs I couldn't quite make out. I saw myself sitting there in the crotch of this fig tree, starving to death, just because I couldn't make up my mind which of the figs I would choose. I wanted each and every one of them, but choosing one meant losing all the rest. As I sat there, unable to decide, the figs began to wrinkle and go black, and one by one they plopped to the ground at my feet.
I feel like that's the story of my life. I didn't know you were going to pick out that section about how when she, you know, when you're fresh out of college and you're like, what the hell do I want to do with my life?
And right. Or in college.
You're in college, yeah. But now that you have just read that and I listened to it again, it pretty much was just like, I don't know what I want to do with my career. Like, I love what I do, and there's so many options even just within that. I'm just kind of like, I want to do that. I want to do this. I want to do that.
Yeah, I mean,
do this.
It doesn't get any better. I'm in my 30s, and it's still the same thing. And
yeah.
Sometimes I wonder about those people who have been on the career. Like, let's take doctors, for example. You know,
yeah.
That is something you need to know early on because you need to be prepped for it. You can't wake up one day at 32, or like I would say that 99% of people cannot wake up at 32 and be like, I want to be a doctor. Yeah. And go from there.
Yeah.
If you had asked me in eighth grade, I would want to be an astronomer. You know, it's yeah. So, and then, I don't know how it became political science. I mean, it's a long, convoluted story.
Did you have to take a physics class? Because that's why I didn't want to be an astronomer.
I don't know. I just like looking through telescopes, and it's just like, I could make a profession out of this, but.
You could be a creep, I mean.
Yeah.
Neighborhood perv.
Yeah.
That's your resume.
Neighborhood voyeur.
The whole time I read it, I was trying to figure out why so many people, like, it has such a cult following.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's it. Unless they're all a bunch of depressed, suicidal people, and then we've got bigger problems. But I think it's more that she writes what so many people go through in such an eloquent way that you're just like, oh, huh. You just put into words all those feelings I have.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's there's the idea that you think people want you to be. There's the idea you think you should be. There's the actual person you want to be. And, you know, then there are variations in between all three and just completely off-the-wall things. But I think part of it as you grow up is the learning that you just because you choose one fig doesn't mean all the other figs necessarily disappear.
Yeah.
There are ways to integrate. I always had this picture in my mind of, like, what the last day of – this is, like, going back, I feel like, in even grade school.
Mm-hmm.
Before I even really had a concept of what college meant and what any of it – but I had a lot of older cousins, and they'd all been to college, and, like – I always just had this sort of vision in my head. The last day of college was me waking up in a dorm and like with my girlfriend, and it was like the greatest day of our lives. And then from there we'd go and graduate, and then it's just smooth sailing and
marriage, kids, and a white picket fence, and a dog.
Maybe, and then flash forward to how many years later, and the day of college graduation, I woke up quite by myself, no job, no direction. At all. You put these, and society puts these kind of ideas about how it should go.
Yeah.
And it's just you learn that just because they did it that way, there's no right or wrong way. Well, there are plenty of wrong ways, but there's no right way for you to do it. It's just about finding what you want slowly over time.
Yeah. So, okay.
And I think you're right. I think it's that indecision, and I don't know what I want, and it's just a fear of, you don't try because you're afraid to fail,
Yeah. So any last thoughts on the book? Anything we didn't discuss that you wanted to discuss?
I liked it more than I thought I would. I wanted to read it just to read it and just have a sense of what it was about, but it was actually really engaging, and she clearly found a way to very well express what she was going through, and I think ultimately it got the better of her at the end, but there was growth for her, I think, in the process. Yeah. And I wonder, like, someone going through that today with all our modern contraptions and the over-medication of the society, like, if the result would have been the same.
Yeah.
You know, because as you and I have talked about, there probably would have been more support for her to, like, admit, not even before it got to the I have a problem stage, but it's like, I don't know what I want. Someone help me talk this through.
She would have been in counseling already.
Yeah, or just,
therapist.
She would have had a group of friends that were similarly minded. It's just like when I have something big, I gather my closest friends together.
Yeah,
and
it's your committee.
Right, and you've been a part of that
committee
before when I had to like kind of move out of my apartment very quickly because my landlords were like criminals. And it's just like I get my committee together and like we talk it through from every way I can think to. And that's what friends do for each other.
I thought of an adaptation for that. They did a modern adaptation of Jane Austen through YouTube videos. That, like, I could see this being adapted. And maybe it's been done. I'll have to do a search. Like a blog post. Like a blog. Or YouTube videos. Her just, talking about New York. Talking about her feelings.
Yeah, and that's kind of, like you said, a modern way to approach the issue. Which is basically, you've got this, I don't want to say privileged, because, like, her family was not, like, the Rockefellers. But she had a lot of opportunities.
Yes, she had a lot more opportunities than most everyone else.
I feel like she was a smart girl who was never told that winning awards and scholarships was pretty cool on its own.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
and somehow
she was born in the right place.
Yeah, right. She had a lot of things going for her. you know, she just became very disillusioned with it and perhaps lacked that. Well, she lacked a lot of people in her lives that needed to tell her specific things, but one of them was the person who was kind of like, you need to check yourself and your privilege.
Slay your role.
It's like, you gotta check your privilege right now. There are 100 people who would kill to be where you are right now. Instead of like bemoaning it, why don't you do something with it?
That's the one thing. I don't think she learned that. Given this is a very small snapshot of her life, and then we know what she went on to do. Although the biography of that book does not make it very clear that she killed herself. I agree. It was much more interesting than I thought it was going to be.
Absolutely.
To wrap up everything else, we will be right back with bookish questions and answers. And we are back, where I now get to interrogate you about your reading habits, your reading preferences, and how you read.
Okay.
It's not an interrogation. It can become one if you answer funny, and I'm like, rah! The very first question I ask everyone is, do you own a current library card?
I do, to the Boston Public Library.
For as long as I've known you, you've lived in Boston proper.
No,
you lived in Medford.
For 4 years, yeah.
For 4 years. Did you have a Minuteman library card or no?
No, I got the Boston library card while I was in Medford. Part of reading these sprawling British naval fiction series is some of them get to like at least 20 books. You go to the bookstore, I next book's not there. And you're just like, I can't just read something else. I need to finish. And I found the Boston Public Library because they have 1,000 branches, so usually you can find what you're looking for. I think I only really had to go searching around once.
Do you remember your first library card and where your first library card was?
I would have been in my hometown of Winchendon, Massachusetts, at the Beals Public Library.
Who's Beal?
Beals were a moneyed family in Winchendon.
Did you get it when you were really young, or did you?
I was in and out of the library. I do remember one summer my parents made a real push for us to try to read throughout the summer, and that must have been like 4th or 5th grade, but okay. I'm sure I had a library card before that.
Oh, nice. You are still technically a current student. Do you use Northeastern's at all, or?
I've not used their library for anything like fun reading since I've been in the PhD program. As an undergrad, I did use the Northeastern Library.
Do they have a good collection of non-academic?
They do. Northeastern was part of the Boston Consortium of Libraries something. You could, by filling out some paperwork, rent from any library in that consortium.
Yeah.
So like Tufts, BU, BC, if they had a book you needed, you could go get it. So I actually, because, you know, I'm a bit of an introvert, I guess, I would take a ride sometimes on a Friday night, maybe a Saturday night. I'd take a ride on the Green Line all the way out to BC, which anyone who lives in Boston is a long ride.
It's a horrible place to go, but yes.
I'd walk over to, I think it's the O'Neill Library. That sounds right. I'd grab a copy of Horatio Hornblower, I'd visit the Student Union, get some gummy bears, and then make the trek back to Northeastern.
You had a thrilling undergrad. I mean, I pretty much did the same. Do you track what you read, like with Goodreads or Shelfari or anything?
No.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's been about 50-50 because I've done some friends that read a lot and some that read a little.
Yeah.
I haven't met anyone who doesn't know how to read because I'm pretty sure all my friends do, but I like that line. Do you own a digital reading device?
I do. I read books on my iPad.
It's like, okay, so you don't have just a dedicated device. You use your iPad.
Yeah.
Okay. How do you like it?
It's good. Well, obviously, less in your bag when you travel, and you can put multiple things on it.
Does the backlight bother you any?
I turn it down. I like it. I like the portability of it. You know, as long as the iPad's with you, you always have your books with you. It's a useful invention. I still like a good book sometimes, though.
Part of this question is sort of like, do you prefer one versus the other? Or is it situational?
I think it's situational. I mean, obviously, like when the power was out, I could have read some of the books on the iPad, but I'm like, well, why burn through the power?
God knows how long it's going to be.
So it's just like, I've got plenty of candles and plenty of paperbacks.
What about audiobooks?
I have listened to the Tina Fey autobiography on audiobook, and it was very good.
That's what everyone recommend. If you're going to do audiobooks, you should do a comedian. They narrate it themselves.
I also downloaded a very brief Reagan biography audiobook 2 summers ago when I was hiking. You know, it was interesting. It was good. I feel like that's probably the extent of it since I was little. I think my parents used to have some audio stuff for the car, like old cassette tapes.
Now, what was the last book you read aside from The Bell Jar? Or have you started one since The Bell Jar? Because I know you read it before I did.
I've not started anything new. I started rereading. It was the first of the original trilogy that he put out.
Beat to Quarters?
Happy Return.
The U.S. title
was Beat to Quarters. Beat to Quarters, meaning when they would drum into battle.
Yeah. Would you say naval fiction is your favorite genre, or would you go broader and say science fiction or fantasy, or like?
I think the broadest fiction, okay, although I do have
narrow.
I do have quite a few like subgenres. Biographical of the U.S. presidents, like Theodore Rex. I mean, everyone has that, but I've got the one before that, which is The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt.
Okay.
Those are really good reads. I think, well, McCullough is a brilliant writer. Egg, okay. He just engages you in that world. You know,
so
he
like
paints
historical
such a.
Fiction, or...
I do. I guess I do like the historical side of it. Although,
but not
I see
romance.
I see a lot of the same, like, you know, Star Wars expanded universe. On your shelf that I had on my shelf. I do like a good science fiction.
The very last question, if you could make me read one book, what would it be?
That's tough, because a lot of the books I read are in series. Like, a lot of the good stuff I read are in series. The original Hornblower trilogy. So it's Beat to Quarters, Ship of the Line, and Flying Colors. It's three books. This is the original three.
Is that trilogy self-contained? Like, you don't have to read everything.
No, exactly, okay. Because those were the original three.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have to have read Midshipman, Lieutenant, Hotspur, or Atropos to know where he's at, because in those trilogies, they have to give the backstory. It's like, here's this guy, and...
So when he wrote those, he was writing it as a trilogy.
Yeah.
Well, you were very lucky that it is Jane Austen's time, and in Jane Austen Book Club, the movie, they mention those, so I might actually...
But I wonder if the character in Hornblower that's Lady Barbara Wellesley is how you know, and... She's a historical liberty that she's created as the daughter or the sister of the Duke of Wellington.
Okay.
Because Wellington was the name he gave himself. Mm-hmm. Wesley was the family name.
Okay.
So I wonder if she's sort of like a mock-up Jane Austen.
Maybe. You know what you need to read? Have you read or watched Doctor Strange and Mr. Norrell?
I've watched Doctor Strange, but...
No, not that one. Susanna Clarke. It is set in that same time period.
Oh.
You will love it. It's basically an alternative history, and magic is being reintroduced into England. The adaptation I thought was really good, but the book itself was also really, really good. That is the end of this episode. You can visit me at my blog, jeffwhaley.com, on Twitter, jeff_whaley. Peter is on Twitter, but he mostly just does Simpsons stuff.
And cutting satirical, political satirical commenting as well.
I'm doing air quotes while he says that. But you can. He is at Pete Antonellis. I will put a link in the show notes. All right, well, thank you for coming. And that's all for now. So, bye.
Bye.